Welcome to Independence, the FIEC podcast. My name's Phil Topham, Executive Director of the FIEC, and it's time for our dive into the news. And with me this week, two people who are boycotting Tate and Lyle over the rebrand this week, which sees that obscure reference from Judges removed from their branding. It is our National Director, John Stevens. Hello, John.
Hi, Phil.
And our Head of National Ministries, Adrian Reynolds. Hello, Adrian. The problem with that one is it's gluten-free. It's something you can actually eat. And now you've got to boycott it.
It is gluten-free, and I care not a jot.
It's really a bit of a non-story. Actually, when you follow it, they're not even removing it from the tin.
Correct. Said
they're only removing it from the plastic bottles in which you've got golden syrup. If you're eating golden syrup from a plastic bottle, you're in the wrong place anyway.
Well, there we are.
So they're still keeping their heritage tin. They've just changed the logo on a kind of a plastic bottle.
These are the stories everyone's talking about. Before we get into...
But we're not going to. Exactly.
Before we get into some of the other things that are going on this week, a couple of updates from us. So new local director this week, or last week rather, joined us, Ben Midgley, in North Wales.
Yeah, we're absolutely delighted. Ben's pastor of the Church of Ebenezer in Mould. We've been wanting to support the work of the gospel in a kind of North Wales. Got a number of churches there. Pete Campbell, who's a pastor there, is also on our trust board. So we, as in other areas of the country, have been seeing, is there any way that we can provide support and help for those churches? And Ben has been seconded by his church a day a week to work for FIEC. So we're paying him a day a week to serve as our director for North Wales. And our hope is that that will strengthen and support the work of the churches there. So we've got a growing team. As I said, our big vision is to want to try to kind of have directors everywhere over the next 2 to 3 years. And it's just wonderful to be able to take another step in that direction.
Excellent. Welcome to Ben. Bookings are open for Thrive and the Ministry Wives Retreat. And it's our first local conference.
We'll say Thrive last week in April.
Yeah,
and
Ministry Wives first couple of days in May. That's right. And Sunderland local conference, that's next week. So do book to get to a local conference. And we'll put something in the show notes about all these. But something else that we'll put in the show notes is your interview with Trevor. He's retiring next week as our
local. Yeah, we finally managed to get rid of him. He wanted me to say that. No, he's after many, many years of service in various churches and with us as FIEC, his time with us is coming to an end. He's still serving in lots of other capacities in many places, but his time with us is coming to an end. We wanted to mark that. We're marking it in London next week at the London Gathering on the 29th of February, and we recorded a short podcast just to honour Trevor and listen to a bit of his wisdom accumulated over many years of ministry.
I want to say Trevor has made a huge contribution to the reshaping of FIEC after the change in 2010. I was asked to become national director, had the opportunity to appoint director for training and other roles. Didn't really know who was going to do that. And actually, I had kind of a coffee with Trevor in a hotel in London, and he happened to say, I'm beginning to think maybe I ought to serve in a different way. And that was just the beginning of a wonderful kind of willingness to come and serve FIEC with a whole load of vision, kind of a desire to want to make FIEC an effective gospel movement, sort of setting up a training fund, helping people into training. And I think, you know, he has just helped reshape the culture and the work of FIEC.
He claims to have put the fun back into fellowship, in which case he's been a miserable failure.
Well, we'll put the links in the show notes to all that. And yes, and it's going to be great to honour Trevor when we gather next week in London. And let's talk about some news stories then. It is soberingly the second anniversary of Russia's invasion of Ukraine.
That was on
the front page of one of the papers I noticed this morning. But the big story that's come out of that conflict this last couple of weeks has been the death of Alexei Navalny, a furious sort of critic of Vladimir Putin, has died in a Siberian jail. Russia say he fell ill following a walk. Read into that what you will. What lessons can we learn from this? It's a brutal war that is ongoing, but anyone who criticizes seems to be in the firing line.
I think that's true. We ought to say, by the way, that although there is some uncertainty about how he precisely died, some claims, for example, he was the recipient of a KGB killer punch. It is clear that along the way he's been poisoned by the Russian state. I think he amazingly got one of the FSB operatives to admit to that on a phone call. So whether the final coup de grace was administered by the state or not, he has been murdered by the state. I think it's pretty clear to say that. And I think that's just part of the massive story that is the situation in Russia and how it's spilled over into Ukraine. So, we can be clear, I think, that he has been murdered by the state.
And I think that's been a pattern with Putin over a period of time. You know, those who oppose him, and actually the background here is there's an election coming up in Russia as well, have mysteriously died.
Yeah. In fact, just this week, a helicopter pilot died in Spain. And you saw this got lost in the news, who had defected with his helicopter to Ukraine, had been rehoused in Spain with a new identity and mysteriously died. So there's lots of this going on.
So there doesn't seem any doubt that there is a program of political assassination of those who are opposed to Pope Putin and his power. And at one level, I'm reading a book at the moment on the history of communism. That's always been the way. Sort of, you know, Stalin basically killed something like 2/3 of his own Politburo because he saw them as rivals. And I think that in a way, Putin is a reversion to a former way of governing. It's the way the Tsars governed. It's the way that communist leaders governed. Yeah, it's extraordinarily difficult to oppose President Putin and all the power that he has and the state forces and the mafia forces that are behind him and that are supporting him. So, I mean, there's no doubt that Navalny was a very brave man to stand against Putin, to expose the corruption of his regime, to oppose the invasion of Crimea, to oppose the invasion of Ukraine. He actually went back to Russia and chose to go back and in that sense put himself at great risk sort of doing that. So he took a kind of a bold and costly stand against a sort of a corrupt, murderous regime.
And there's something said about his Christian faith as well, Adrian?
Yes, I mean, there have been a few reports about things that he's written and said about his Christian faith. It's always difficult to know from a distance, isn't it? And I have no reason to doubt the sincerity of what he's written, but I don't know him. I don't know anybody who knows him. And I think clearly if he is, I hope he did die a Christian because that's ultimately the only hope for anybody, isn't it? There is no other way to salvation other than through Jesus Christ. So I hope he died a Christian. It does make me just reflect slightly on our rapidity as Christians to claim people for our own. We like to claim people, I think, as Christians when they say something kind of vaguely Christian. I think probably there's a bit more than that with Navalny, but I just think in general we claim people as Christians who say something vaguely Christian. I think that's probably, this could be a bit controversial, but I think that's probably the case with the late Queen, maybe. Ooh, don't write in. Or if you do, write to Phil Topham. And I think that's a failure to really believe in common grace. Obviously, we want people to be Christians and we want them to die believing. But I think we want to believe that good and altruistic acts and kind acts, and in Navalny's case, the clear and courageous pursuit of justice and truth are only reserved for Christians. And that's just not the case. I think we do need to have a good doctrine of common grace, and we need to believe in total depravity, but we need to understand that properly. That doesn't mean that everybody's as bad as they could be. And actually, God, in his amazing goodness, as he works out everything, as Paul says in Ephesians, in conformity with the purpose of his will, uses sometimes fallen creatures, whoever they may be, to pursue all kinds of good ends. So there are wonderful Muslim doctors. There are amazing Hindu politicians. So I think we've got to be a little bit careful about wanting to claim people just so that we can say, you know, this is the only way that righteousness and truth are going to be pursued. There's a bit more going on. But, John, you might have a broad view about his faith.
I don't know a great deal about Navalny's personal faith. You're absolutely right. Kind of common grace, God can raise up people who can campaign against injustice, pursue kind of good government, who are kind of from other religions, who are atheists. In Navalny's case, I mean, his personal testimony is, I was a militant atheist and I've become a Christian. So for him, there's sort of an element of significant change, which is actually slightly different from someone who maybe has been brought up in a Christian culture and has always gone to church and you kind of make assumptions. So there's no doubt that there was something changed kind of there. Again, whether that's genuine faith in Christ is not for me to say. But I was reading a book recently by Justin Brierley, very much talking about how people in the modern world are, in a sense, turning away from atheism to theism and then perhaps on to Christian faith because they realize that the atheist kind of view of the world simply doesn't kind of work. So I think there's an element of, at least in his case, a significant change from being an active atheist. I think the sadness in Russia, though, is that so much of the Russian church and the Russian Orthodox Church supports Putin. It's absolutely extraordinary. The Russian patriarch, a kind of a sort of Russian nationalist mysticism, and actually kind of Putin's behavior, his invasion of Iraq, of Ukraine, is kind of cast in terms of some sort of saving of Western Christian civilization. And I think at the same time, we ought to recognize that that is simply an appalling act on the part of those churches that are supporting and upholding Putin and what he is doing, that Christianity can easily be misused. And we see when it's associated with a kind of a nationalism that justifies that kind of behavior, that is far away from the role of the church and the teaching of Christ.
And the Navalny situation has to some extent taken attention away from Ukraine and what's going on in Ukraine. And as you say, it's the second anniversary, the invasion of Ukraine, and it's largely fallen from the headlines, I think, because of what's happening in the Middle East. But we mustn't forget that situation. We mustn't forget how difficult it is. In fact, there's all kinds of things happening. This month, very close to this month, there are provisions for Ukrainians in the UK that are being removed. They've come to an end. They've expired. So you can't get visas for dependents, for example, anymore in the same way you used to be able to.
How are they extended visas, though, for people who are already here?
Yeah, but not for dependents. Right. So if you've got a child, you can't now bring them on a dependent visa anymore as of, I think, last month. So the situation is changing. The week before last, it would appear a major Russian surface vessel was sunk by Ukraine. But at the same time, Ukraine is having to pull back from defending a major city because of lack of ammunition and resources. There's a lot of fuss in the States about exactly how much support the US government might provide. So that the whole situation, I think, is very, very delicately balanced. And we must go on praying. Yeah. And this Sunday is a good Sunday to do that. Second anniversary, you may, like our church, have people from Ukraine in your church or have connections. So it's a good Sunday to remember the situation in your prayers.
And I think that's a reminder to us that war often requires sort of significant, massive investment of resources over a long period of time in order to win. And I think we kind of are very reluctant to make that sort of investment. And kind of Ukraine is the little guy here. And only with Western support does it have any ability to be able to defend itself. But yet the European nations haven't been able to deliver the quantity of shells that have been promised because our industry is so kind of reduced in terms of ability to produce that stuff. And in America, it seems the Americans are playing politics. Yeah. And the Republicans are simply refusing to vote the support that Ukraine needs because they want to get other stuff out of Biden for their own internal political reasons. You kind of have to say, in the end, I think most people think that it's important that Putin is not allowed to kind of win, expand, that others will then be at risk if they do that. But in order to do that, you have to put the resources in over the long term.
We pray on for Ukraine, and a good reminder to do that this weekend on the second anniversary of that invasion. It's not the only conflict, of course. The world is in conflict in lots of different places. The ongoing war in the Middle East is still in our headlines. Focusing a little bit closer to home, we saw extraordinary scenes in Parliament this week as a proposal was put by the Scottish National Party this past Wednesday. They wanted to call for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. And then there was something that happened that the Speaker of the House did, which has caused a bit of a kerfuffle. As I understand it, he could choose which amendments to the proposal were debated, and he chose the Labour amendment, which cued absolute fury from both the SNP and the Conservatives. And essentially, the Houses of Parliament looked like a bit of a mess on Wednesday, didn't it?
Who's going to answer that? John can answer it first, and then I'll come in with my amazing wisdom on the whole situation.
Well, yeah, that is what happened. So Parliament was debating kind of Gaza. I think the SNP, as you say, put a motion forward demanding an immediate ceasefire. Labour wanted to put a proposal forward that was slightly different, that was speaking about an immediate kind of humanitarian ceasefire. In other words, they weren't wanting to say that this was necessarily the end of the conflict, and that they were saying that Israel didn't have the ongoing right to continue to defend itself and beat Hamas. So it was subtly different. And the Speaker chose to put the Labour amendment to the kind of chamber first ahead of the SNP amendment, which was a breach of protocol and a breach of the kind of procedure, which is where the outrage then kind of came for. The suspicion is that he was trying to protect Keir Starmer because there were a lot of Labour MPs who would have voted for the SNP kind of measure. He put it in terms of wanting to protect MPs and their safety because of the way that they are being kind of lobbied against and protests outside their houses over the whole kind of Hamas kind of situation.
How seriously should we take that? So there seems to be a huge amount of debate on both sides that this is actually being whipped up by the right, but actually it's not as serious as we're being led to believe. Do you have any sense, John, of how big a problem that is?
Well, I think there's a bigger problem in our political culture of MPs being subject to threats because they don't do what people want, and the whole of social media and the way that that has enabled people to protest outside people's houses. It's not surprising that large numbers of people no longer want to enter into politics when they face that kind of risk, which is involved. And you know, again, it's being debated. Is it a democratic right to protest in that way, or is actually that an undermining of democracy because it basically places pressure on MPs? But in the kind of the bigger kind of House of Commons issues, in effect, what the sort of Speaker did was he went against the usual conventions of the House, which is why people kind of walked out. He's apologised for doing that, saying that he had sort of motives for why he did that, but I think has recognised that that was not the right thing to do in this kind of situation. And irrespective of, I think, the wider whole Gaza question and how people approach that, actually there is a lesson here just in terms of procedures, conventions, ways of doing things are there to enable proper debate to be conducted and for everybody to be able to engage in that process. And it's not surprising that people are upset when there is a sort of a kind of a breaking of those conventions in a way that looks biased to achieve a particular kind of result. And I think that applies actually to an awful lot of meetings, church meetings, the way that things are done. The power of the chair is very significant, and that needs to be used extremely carefully, not simply to achieve a kind of an agenda, subverting the expected processes.
I think there's probably even more going on than that, in that the root cause is everybody is politicking here. So the SNP, the SNP proposal was deliberately written to divide Labour. So because SNP are under challenge from Labour in Scotland, they could lose a lot of seats, it looks like, at the forthcoming general election. So they deliberately wanted to divide the Labour front bench.
And that's and one Labour. Of the criticisms. This wasn't really about Gaza, this was about politics.
Well, indeed. So they were politicking. The opposition motions are by convention hardly ever opposed by government, because they never win if the government's got a majority. So the Tory party put forward an amendment as well, which by convention they don't normally do. And then the Labour Party put forward a convention. Now, in those circumstances, a speaker would normally have called the Tory party the government's amendment, not the Labour Party's amendment. So everybody was politicking. And I think the speaker was slightly caught up in that. And I think he was right to apologise. You've used different words, John, and I'm not sure they're all quite right. So you've talked about procedure and you've talked about convention. And they're not quite the same thing, are they? Because actually he has broken no rules.
And he's just not done what was expected of him.
He's not done what was normally done.
Yeah.
So I think part of the problem with our parliamentary system, it seems to me anyway, is that it is largely unwritten. I mean, there are massive books that are consulted, and there is a lot of precedent in terms of how things are done, but there are actually not many rules. And I think, especially as churches get larger, if we want to protect ourselves from politicking and parties and factions, actually procedures and policies are not just boring and dull, but important. They are critical, actually, to making sure things happen fairly. So how do you protect the chair? I think you're right, John, that the chair of, let's say, an elders meeting or a meeting of church members has an extraordinary amount of power in some ways. How do you protect both the church and the individual in those circumstances? And the answer is you have good procedures and policies. So I think as churches grow, especially, and they move from being very familial and community to being larger, where not everybody knows everybody and not everyone trusts everybody, perhaps they don't know everybody, the place of those policies and procedures and rules, if you like, become really, really important for protecting the integrity of God's people and how things are conducted. So I think there's a deep lesson here that we mustn't, as leaders in churches, we mustn't think that the writing of policies and the setting of rules for these kinds of things is kind of dull and boring, and it'll just wait another day. Can't we just get on with Christians? Actually, we've got to protect ourselves and the integrity and the truthfulness of what happens in church life.
I think that's really important from an independent church perspective as well, isn't it? So John, could you just comment on that in terms of what needs to be in place to run a church meeting well as an independent? Because that is something that I think it's easy to get wrong, but actually having those right policies and procedures in place actually serves leaders, I would say.
Yeah, well, that all comes down to the constitution and the rules, which make very clear where power is located, how decisions are made. So you need to have great clarity as to how decisions are made. So for example, in church life, who makes a decision to appoint a pastor? What kind of vote is needed for that? How is that to be undertaken? Who appoints the elders? How is church discipline done in the context of the church?
How are elders and pastors removed as well? Yeah. That needs to be part of it.
Who decides how money is to be spent? And then how is the meeting to be conducted? And getting basic principles of giving people enough notice of what's going to be discussed and decided, not landing things on them there and then, making sure that there's proper discussion, making sure that there is kind of proper voting. And I think that the procedure provides a framework for those decisions, but it needs wisdom in leadership to judge the meeting. And actually, it's sort of wisdom to decide when it's not appropriate to make a decision at this point, because clearly that would be not helpful and you need to reflect on it more and come back sort of again. So I think it's a combination of clear rules that everybody understands plus a wisdom in actually leading the meeting.
Yeah. So we actually vote at our church. We sometimes vote for things we don't need to vote for.
Yeah.
According to the rules, just because it's nice to get everyone on board, and it's kind of that becomes a wisdom call at that point. So yeah, that's helpful, John, to think about it as a mixture of those two things, rules and wisdom.
And I think as we reflect on Gaza, we mustn't forget that at one level there are all these procedural questions. It's also a reflection, really, to some extent, of how limited Parliament and its role is in this. You know, no matter what they vote, is that going to change what's happening on the ground? Probably kind of not. The reality is there's an unfolding tragedy in a kind of Gaza, which is deeply intractable. I don't know what the answer is to it. There are something like 28,000 people, according to Hamas, who've been killed in Gaza, but 9,000...
Some would say that's been very inflated.
It may well have been, but that's their figure. And, and on their figure, something like 9,000 Hamas fighters have been killed. So Israel's kind of goal has been to destroy Hamas and you know, their antipathy and terrorist activity against kind of Israel. On the other side, there doesn't seem to be any willingness on the part of Israel to kind of come up with a long-term solution as to how this kind of fundamental kind of rights of the Palestinians, how that can be kind of worked out. So it feels a very, very intractable kind of situation. And at a distance, it's easier for people to vote on motions, but that isn't actually going to resolve the issues kind of on the ground.
So the Israeli parliament voted this week firmly against the two-state solution, and whether you think that's wise or not, that door now appears to be firmly closed.
Again, needs much prayer, as does the Russia-Ukraine
and insight. I think we often lack insight in these situations.
And a humility, just a recognition that we don't necessarily have the answers and we might have opinions, but that doesn't mean to say that that is what's going to happen. And nor is it primarily our responsibility as just an ordinary Christian. We can pray, we can ask for God to work in that situation. We need to remember our brothers and sisters on both sides.
And as leaders too, we need to be helping people with these kind of world crises that exist to see that God is still working his purposes out. You know, the great cosmic plan of God is unaffected. And in some mysterious, inexplicable way, these are all parts of the detail of the plan of him who works out everything in conformity with the purpose of his will. That's a hard truth to grasp, but we've got to give people confidence that God is working his purposes out, even in the mess and the mystery and the kind of just the perplexity of life.
And that the focus on Gaza, you know, there are other parts of the world, there are equally tragic and even sort of more significant situations. So it's estimated over 600,000 people have been killed in Syria by the regime there. In Yemen, it's estimated it's sort of 350,000 or so people have been killed in Yemen because of the conflict that's going on there. We were hearing in our church about what's happening in Nigeria and all of the troubles in northern Nigeria with Islamic extremists kind of there. Still ongoing civil war in Sudan, appalling treatment of people in North Korea. So at one level, the spotlight is on one particular place, but actually in a fallen world, there's just appalling... behavior.
And around the world, Phil, I'm feeding you a line here, many babies being killed through the dreadful evil of abortion.
And we all say, don't we, come Lord Jesus and Lord have mercy. Absolutely. But let's go there next. So there's been a couple of interlinking stories on either side of the pond this past week. One from Alabama in the States, whereby a ruling's been made that embryos created through IVF are human beings. Which is a fascinating decision that's been taken in Alabama. Similarly, in Britain, we've heard this week that the government's going to introduce what are called baby loss certificates. And for those who've miscarried, lost a baby before 24
weeks. Not going to, they have.
No, what I mean is they are, if you ask for them, they are going to issue them, is the point I'm making. This seems fascinating to me because of what it's saying about what we believe about human life. It seems that both of those things, what's happened in Alabama and what's happened with the baby loss certificates, seem to suggest there is something absolutely intrinsically valuable about human life from conception and forwards. And actually, people want to recognize that. But at the same time, the horror of abortion is still apparent. How do we hold these things in tension? That's ridiculous, isn't it? Surely we're saying that human life is absolutely from conception, the right way to think of those who are pregnant.
Well, I think certainly from a Christian perspective, that is absolutely right. The reality is that the secular world doesn't think like that. So
why do this with the baby loss certificates? Why do it?
Well, because I think what's underlying that is actually the approach that's taken in a secular sort of context is actually what matters is whether or not the child, the baby, is wanted. That seems to be the kind of the fundamental moral proposition which determines how people view abortion, IVF, and as you say, miscarriage. And I think there is a, from a Christian perspective, a deep kind of inconsistency in that. But that is, at least in the secular world, that is the underlying kind of ethos.
Why is it inconsistent from a Christian perspective?
Well, because the value of the child doesn't depend upon whether or not that child is particularly wanted. Mm. So, I mean, in Alabama is one of the kind of most pro-life states in the US with the kind of removing of Roe and Wade. The issue of abortion was passed down to the states. Alabama is a state that sort of rejects abortion kind of entirely. And at one level, the ruling is entirely consistent because it recognizes that a fertilized embryo, even for the purposes of IVF, is just as much kind of a child as a child kind of in a mother's womb. Mm. So at one level, if the starting point is life begins at conception, then that applies irrespective of where the conception takes place. So the issue that was being decided here was kind of, was it wrongful death on the part of a kind of an IVF clinic to allow these fertilized embryos to be destroyed by kind of unfreezing? And at one level, it's an entirely logical position if you believe that life starts at kind of the point of conception. And I think in terms of people thinking from a pro-life perspective, it's all too easy not to take into account things like IVF, even some forms of contraception that are essentially forms of kind of abortion. There is a real, in a sense, logical kind of coordination there that if the fundamental principle is that is when life starts, then that has to apply across the board. So I think in many ways, the Alabama Supreme Court is simply drawing a kind of a logical implication of their starting kind of position. What was extraordinary in the court is the way that the court kind of referred to the Bible and Christian theologians as the part of the basis of kind of deciding that. So the Chief Justice of the kind of Alabama Supreme Court wrote in his judgment this: human life cannot be wrongfully destroyed without incurring the wrath of a holy God who views the destruction of his image as an affront to himself. This is true of unborn human life no less than of all other human life, that even before birth, all human beings bear the image of God and their lives cannot be destroyed without effacing his glory. Mm. Now, I think that actually reveals the depth of the difference between a kind of a very religious kind of context in the US. You would never find an English judge speaking in those terms kind of in court. It reveals actually a very different framework of how moral decisions are judged and viewed. So I think the Alabama court decision is actually logically entirely appropriate if your starting point is, as I believe the Bible teaches, that life starts at conception. Abortion is justified in a secular context on the ground that the mother has the right to choose basically whether they want this child or not. And it is down to whether or not the child is wanted within the limits that the law allows. And it is the mother's decision. The father doesn't have any say in whether the child is wanted or not. And I think that the kind of decision about the kind of certificates of child loss, they reflect that in many cases where a child is wanted, there is an immense grief felt where that sort of child is lost. And the importance of those certificates is they're before the age of 28 weeks.
So 24.
24 weeks. Mm. So there are early stages when actually abortion would be available. And from a Christian perspective, you think that does seem deeply inconsistent, that you're recognizing here that the felt experience is the loss of a precious child, whereas at the same time, the law doesn't afford rights to those children. But as I said, I think from the secular perspective, it is down to the value of this child is on whether I believe I want it or not.
Adrian, would you comment on the importance of pastoral care for those who've experienced.
Yes, I'm glad you raised that because I was going to raise it myself. I think there will be many people. I mean, the number of miscarriages in the UK is very large and lots of couples do suffer miscarriages. And there will be people in your church, even people listening to this, who have gone through the pain and grief of miscarriage and still going through the pain and grief of miscarriage. And we need to be aware of that as we speak about these issues and as we preach, as we try and apply God's word to people's situations. We need to realize that there are some things often that are very private that people don't talk about, but are deeply felt. There are a couple of resources I'd love to recommend. Good Book Company in the last couple of years have produced two books, one for men, one for women. I've commended the book for men on those going through miscarriages as couples. The Good Book Company tell me they've both been surprisingly bestsellers for them. There's a real need to provide pastoral help. I think actually they're good books for pastors to read, just to think about the help they can provide in the loss and the grief of losing a child. So please, as we talk about these things, don't underestimate the pastoral impact of that. And I think just reflecting on it evangelistically, we sometimes think that these are great opportunities to point out the inconsistencies and logical fallacies that exist in unbelievers' minds. I think that this is a thing, as John's just articulated, this is a logical fallacy, but I think we mustn't overestimate the benefit that there could be of arguing that in terms of an evangelistic context. There are plenty of other things in law that are inconsistent. You know, we pour lots of resources into helping people who have suicidal thoughts, and yet we're entertaining thoughts of end-of-life issues, essentially a suicide, assisted suicide, because those consistent inconsistencies don't really resonate with people. So I think we need to be clear that we need to be active in the public square. We need to point out these inconsistencies, but I don't think they're going to win people for the gospel necessarily by having these inconsistencies pointed out. People are won for the gospel when they're confronted with Christ in all his beauty and wonder. We've got to not mistake an apologetic for moral issues with the cause of the, you know, the proclaiming the gospel. And they may have a part to play, but they are not the gospel.
I think, Pastor, on another element to that, you're absolutely right. There are those who've obviously suffered the grief of kind of miscarriage who need comfort for that. Actually, as a reality in modern Britain, there are a large number of women who will have had abortions that has happened. And we need to recognise that when we're preaching, when we're kind of engaging even people in our own churches, there will be those who have had abortions. We need to preach the grace and the mercy of Christ. Actually, yes, we want to identify sin, but actually the good news is that forgiveness is available through the Lord Jesus. So we need to be proclaiming that grace there. I think on the whole area of IVF as well, we need to be thoughtful about that. I think Christians can be unthinking about the nature of kind of IVF. There are ways of engaging in IVF that don't produce multiple embryos, many of which then end up being destroyed. So there are what you might call more Christian ethical models of IVF, but we mustn't be unthinking about that. Of course, in the end, those end up tending to be more expensive because of the procedures that are involved. But I think that, we need to kind of help people to think through some of those issues as well. And in terms of the broader kind of pro-life case and argument being made, I think it's a reality that the law is the way it is in Alabama because that reflects the views of the people of the state of Alabama, because there's a sort of a strong Christian community who hold strong pro-life kind of views. It's naive to think that kind of a central government or other is going to be able to impose that kind of view against the will of a people. It is ultimately a reflection. You see that in the States when Roe and Wade was kind of overturned and it was put down to the states in lots of votes. States that were even thought to be conservative have voted to maintain and support kind of abortion. So there's not the popular support for the pro-life case. And I think in the long run, it requires a change of people's attitudes. And often that's actually associated with a religious faith, a Christian faith that does value life from conception. And to some extent, our law reflects the views of kind of the majority of the people.
Adrian, as we come to an end of this podcast, I'd like you to give us 30 seconds on Samantha Morton winning a fellowship at the BAFTAs. You were really keen to get this in.
She's a great actress, Samantha Morton, born in the 70s, British actress. She won the fellowship, which is kind of a lifetime achievement. She's quite young to be winning that, but she has had a remarkable career. What I love about Samantha Morton is she's not an A-lister. In the sense of, I mean, she's a fantastic actress, don't get me wrong, but, you know, if there are pictures of the red carpet, it's never Samantha Morton who's on the front page of the newspaper. She's been nominated for Oscars, but she's never won an Oscar. She is not afraid to do BBC dramas alongside Hollywood. She turns a hand to anything. In many ways, she is the epitome of an ordinary, I use that word carefully, an ordinary but extraordinary actress. actor, however you want to define the terms. And it was interesting that when she got the award, there was universal warmth and appeal for her. Standing ovation, clearly not just contrived, people very warm towards her, really respected her. And it struck me as I was watching, I'd been away and I watched it on catch up, and I was just watching her and watched her speech and the kind of the things she gets involved in. It just made me think there is something here for leaders of churches. You know, the stage is not the thing, the glamour posts, the authorships are not the thing. It is the ordinary, extraordinary work of pastoring the local church, whatever that means, getting on with it, doing a great job, pouring yourself into it without worrying about whether you're going to get invited to speak at the Gospel Coalition or whatever else it may be. And frankly, just as Samantha Morton was honoured on Sunday, we need to, and we want to, honour those who are serving churches in exactly that same way. Perhaps they'll never have obituaries in the Times or whatever else it may be, but they are to be honoured. And one day the Lord will say to them, well done, good and faithful servant. That is our calling. That's what we're called to. We're called to that ordinary, extraordinariness. And I thought the fellowship was given to Samantha Morton was a great picture of that.
Can I throw in another BAFTA one that adds on top of that?
Go on.
You're going to diminish.
You've got seconds. We're 35 minutes.
Did we spot the bit where there was the kind of the best film award went to Oppenheimer, and the guy who was the YouTuber came up on stage
to
collect the award? Right. Yep. So people didn't really kind of quite notice at the time, and he was sort of standing there. So he kind of was up on stage while the award was being presented, and then actually afterwards was kicked out by security because of what he'd done. I think that in a way is an illustration of the gospel story, isn't it? That's the guy at the wedding banquet who's not wearing the right clothes. So the kind of the one who is honoured, the Samantha Morton, because of her kind of great sort of faithful service over so long. Yeah. And here is the fake, who is also kind of, in the end, ultimately exposed and kicked out.
Let not the fake be the last thing we talk about.
No.
So I've got two words for you, Samantha Morton.
Excellent. FIEC at the cultural edge. Excellent. Lots of weighty things in today's podcast. Thank you for engaging with it. Do pray on for Russia, Ukraine. Do pray on for the Israel-Gaza conflict. Do pray on for the unborn. These things are weighty matters, aren't they? And we come to a God who knows all things, and we need to reflect wisely on all these things. Brothers, thank you for joining us. This has been Independence, the FIEC podcast. Do rate, leave a review so others can find it, and we'll look forward to speaking to you again soon.
Thanks, Phil.
Thank you.